From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the state of the Russia-U.S. peace deal on Ukraine that seemed to leave out Ukraine. Then Ron Elving on the week in politics. And later, Charlie Shackleton lost bidding rights on a true crime documentary, so he's made a film to show all the cliché techniques he would have used to stretch reality.
I think what's interesting about the ethics of true crime is how those sorts of fairly minor distortions can fairly easily give way to much more serious ones. And that's something that the film tries to grapple with, is where you draw that line.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, November 22nd, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Authorities are investigating a Wednesday night fire at a Staples apartment complex. A news release from the Staples Fire Department says responders were dispatched around 9:30 p.m. for an activated smoke detector and general fire alarm at the high-rise apartments. Firefighters were advised there was smoke on the second floor of the 60-unit complex. They located a person in the second floor apartment where the fire started. They were eventually airlifted to a metro hospital. The fire was contained in a single unit, but several tenants were displaced due to minor smoke damage. They are receiving services from the Red Cross. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension identified the man shot and killed and the deputies involved in a deadly exchange of gunfire in Onegum on Sunday. The BCA confirmed 37-year-old James Weyes of Onegum was killed. The Minnesota Star Tribune reported he was the former foster son of Leech Lake Tribal Chairman Farron Jackson. The agency's initial investigation found Cass County deputies were called Sunday afternoon on a report of shots fired. While responding, they passed Weyes walking alone on a nearby road. According to the BCA, Deputy Caleb Churn attempted to speak with Weyes, but he ran from him. Churn pursued him on foot. The two exchanged gunfire, and Churn was struck in the right thigh. He was airlifted to a Fargo hospital and has since been released. Deputy David Donner was responding to the foot chase when he saw Weyes emerge onto the road. Donner shot Weyes, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Donner and Churn are on critical incident leave. The BCA will continue its investigation and then present its findings to the Cass County Attorney's Office for further review. A petition is circulating to force a vote by the public on whether a consolidation between the Renshaw and neighboring Carleton school districts moves forward. The Cloquet Pine Journal reports that with the signatures of 5% of eligible voters in the Renshaw School District, the petition could trigger a special election. That would determine whether the schools would consolidate versus leaving it in the hands of the elected school boards. The topic of consolidation in the area is not new, but the Pine Journal reports the school boards finally voted for consolidation in October and plan to have a second vote in January. The boards want to consolidate by next June. Shelley Raskovich and Barb Carnes hadn't been to the Nashwauk High School since they graduated in 1972. Carnes lives in Grand Rapids, but Raskovich drove all the way from Duluth to visit the school one last time Friday with their classmates Wendy Grease and Carolyn Johnson.
Yeah, wow. So we have to do a walkthrough, one final.
Yeah.
Walk through and see who we remember, the classes, yeah. The teachers, the kids.
Yes.
The kids who are no longer
and
kids.
And things that have changed since we were here.
Yeah, you know? Definitely have changed.
The Nashwauk-Keewatin School District hosted a liquidation sale, selling off chairs, doors, books, whatever was left in the century-old building. People were lined up at the doors before the sale began, and over 200 people had been through with 2 hours to go. The district moved into its new pre-K through 12 building this fall, and the historic Nashwauk High School and Keewatin Elementary are slated for demolition in the coming weeks.
It's, you know, sad. It's sad. To see this go.
It is sad to, yeah, see it go. You know, I'd like to see it fixed.
You know,
yeah, repurposed for something.
A historic mosaic from the library has already been removed and will be going up in the new school next year. Walking the halls brought up a lot of memories for the girlfriends from 72. Coming up with excuses so they didn't have to swim in gym class, climbing out the windows onto the lawn, a mean math teacher, and school lunch thieves.
And so, to get even, two people put cat food on their sandwiches. So if you're going to steal our lunches, they got cat food.
Alumni and school board members Barb Colmy and Don Warwis shared memories of the school too, like watching games from the gym balcony.
You know, that's how we students got, if you weren't sitting in the bleachers underneath, you hung over the top of the rail.
It wasn't much for bleachers, it was just a little bit. Yeah. You were right in the game.
Another liquidation sale is planned for Keewatin Elementary on December 5th, but Colmy says asbestos abatement has already started there, which may lead to that sale being canceled. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump says the U.S. has a new peace plan to end the war in Ukraine, and he strongly urges Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky to sign on.
Yeah, we have a way of getting peace. We think we have a way of getting peace. He's going to have to approve it.
That's the president at the Oval Office yesterday. President Trump says he expects Zelensky to give an answer by Thursday. The U.S. plan provides some security guarantees for Ukraine, but it also codifies several longstanding Russian demands. NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
What do we know about this plan?
Well, first of all, it's a draft plan, and the White House officials have confirmed to NPR its contents could change. But as it's publicly presented now, it's rather extensive. 28 separate points, something of a laundry list for a post-conflict Ukraine, everything from when elections might be held to how Ukraine is rebuilt and who pays for it. But to actually stop the fighting, the key elements include calls for Ukraine to cede territory in the Donbas, including land that Russia has not been able to conquer in more than 3 years of fighting. It calls for limits to Ukraine's military, including caps on troops and certain weapons. And it calls for Ukraine to formally renounce ambitions to join NATO. You know, all clearly Russian demands, which is perhaps not surprising, given that a Kremlin envoy helped draft it with White House officials.
Is there anything for Ukraine to like here?
Well, to a degree, yes. The plan also codifies Ukraine's right to try and join the European Union, which, as a sovereign country, it should have the right to do anyway. Also, security guarantees, including a provision that says an attack on Ukraine would be seen as an attack on the transatlantic alliance, at least for the next 10 years. So something like a temporary NATO Article 5 clause. That's something Ukraine has long wanted, even though there are questions and even doubts about how ironclad a promise like that would be.
Here in Moscow, of course, Charles, what's the reaction from Russians?
You know, it's been a strange week. The more details that came out about this plan, the less the Kremlin had to say. That finally changed last night, though.
Полагаю, что и он может быть положен в основу окончательного.
So that's Russian President Vladimir Putin heard here, who says the U.S. plan could be used as the basis for a final peaceful settlement, even as he went on to warn the details had not been discussed substantively with Russia. Now Putin offered a theory why. He said it likely meant the U.S. had yet to convince Ukraine to accept the deal, but more ominously, he said it didn't matter. He said Moscow preferred diplomacy, but would achieve its goals in Ukraine militarily if need be.
And what about Ukraine's response? Because there are some enormous concessions you mentioned.
Yeah, huge concessions. And some would argue this plan essentially rewards the aggressor. President Volodymyr Zelensky issued a public statement to the nation last night, which he said the country was facing one of its most difficult moments. Let's listen.
Зараз Україна може опинитися перед дуже складним вибором.
So here Zelensky says right now Ukraine may find itself facing a very tough choice, either losing its dignity or alienating its key partner, the U.S. But rather than immediately say no to Trump, Zelensky said his focus would be on presenting counterproposals.
NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Charles, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene announced last night she will resign in January. A Georgia Republican said that other than diverging from President Trump on a few issues, including the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files, she has been loyal to President Trump.
My voting record has been solidly with my party and the president. Loyalty should be a two-way street.
And Pierre's Ron Elving joins us. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
In response to Representative Taylor Greene's announcement, President Trump called her a traitor on Truth Social this morning. Does this tell us something more about what's going on in the Republican Party?
Surely it's the cost of crossing swords with this particular president. Insisting on absolute loyalty has been a Trump trademark. But this falling out also says something about what's going on in the party. The remarkable unity that has bolstered Republicans in the Trump era has been tested not only by the Epstein files, but by deep differences over policy, especially foreign policy on Ukraine and most especially on Israel.
President Trump also this week took aim at some Democratic lawmakers, accusing them of sedition over a video they released saying that members of the military are legally allowed to refuse unlawful orders. President wrote in a post online, this is, quote, punishable by death. And what kind of threat is this, especially at a time when we've seen violence against public figures, including President Trump himself?
It's akin to the way Trump has talked about people who defied him in the past, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top uniformed officer of the United States, who refused to assist Trump's efforts to defy election results in 2020. Now, the fact is, our armed forces swear an oath to defend the Constitution and to follow orders so long as they are lawful. The challenge is what to do when orders clearly go beyond what is lawful.
President Trump on Thursday signed the bill allowing for the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files. Total reversal of his course, of course. What's next and when?
We're supposed to wait up to 30 days to see what's in the files, but there are a lot of question marks. What are the exceptions, the off-ramps, the special circumstances that might withhold some of the files or parts of them? Who's going to decide and who will review that decision and who might push back if the files do not all come out?
The latest NPR PBS News Marist poll this week shows 80% of Americans have little or no confidence in Congress. Now, of course, we ought to add that political parties, the Supreme Court, the presidency, the media score only slightly better. What could this mean as we enter midterm campaigns?
Right now, Trump's poll numbers are falling, and they're right where they were 8 years ago, heading into a cycle where his party lost big and lost control in the House, 2018. And the departure of Marjorie Taylor Greene and others signals a deeper unease within the GOP over the economy and the general perception of Trump and his policies. That means incumbents who usually would not have any trouble getting reelected might struggle this time, and that's good. Whichever party's in power, that's good for democracy. It means incumbents have to campaign and defend their votes. But Scott, let me walk back something I said last week. I said there were no more elections coming up before the next showdown and shutdown over health insurance. I should have said there were not any more multi-state election days or big tests or something like that, because there is a special election coming up in a deep red district in Tennessee. There's a Trump-endorsed Republican named Matt Van Epps and a Democrat who's a state legislator from Nashville, and her name is Afton Bain. Trump won that district by 22 points in 2024, but polls show the current race tightening, and the voting is on December 2nd.
NPR's Ron Elving, thanks so much for being with us. Speak to you soon.
Thank you, Scott.
When President Trump welcomed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the Oval Office this week, a reporter asked about Jamal Khashoggi. The Saudi journalist was murdered in 2018, according to U.S. intelligence agencies, in an operation approved by the Crown Prince. "You're mentioning somebody that was extremely controversial," the president replied. "A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen." Jamal Khashoggi came from a prominent Saudi family but fled his country in June 2017 after he'd become increasingly critical of his government. He said he'd been banned from using Twitter. He began to write columns for the Washington Post with a candid admission. "It was painful for me several years ago when several friends were arrested," he wrote. "I said nothing. I didn't want to lose my job or my freedom. I worried about my family. I have made a different choice now. I have left my home, my family, and my job, and I am raising my voice. To do otherwise would betray those who languish in prison. I can speak when so many cannot." The following summer, the Crown Prince lifted the traditional ban on women driving, but first, his government arrested numerous women's rights advocates, accusing them of nefarious contacts with foreign parties. "The message is clear to all," wrote Jamal Khashoggi. "Activism of any sort has to be within the government, and no independent voice or counter-opinion will be allowed. Everyone must stick to the party line." Just a few months after he wrote those words, Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to pick up documents for his marriage. His fiancée waited outside for him for hours. Jamal Khashoggi never got out of that building. But his voice went on. His last column, published after his death, called for free expression in the Arab world and warned that the region's governments have been given free rein to continue silencing the media. Jamal Khashoggi knew, as he wrote, that some powerful people could find his words not just extremely controversial, as President Trump put it, but threatening to their power. He wrote them anyway, whether they liked him or not.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I found a song.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. I was like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, November 24th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month, and the board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. There is a health fair at the Itasca County Family YMCA in Grand Rapids on Monday, 2 to 5. Several free screenings will be offered, including bone density and glucose testing. And the 16th annual Brainerd Turkey Run is Thanksgiving morning, beginning at 9 from the Brainerd Armory. Proceeds benefit Shriners Hospitals for Kids. Runner walk 1 mile or 5 kilometers. Find more info and register at BrainerdTurkeyRun.com. At 10 o'clock this morning, Back Porch Harmony with Jen Buie. Right now, we continue with Weekend Edition.
Comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Firefighters in Wilmington, North Carolina, not far from where B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music, hangs his hat, wanted to make certain people know how to properly fry a turkey. The cooking style is one of the biggest fire risks on Thanksgiving because, well, the pot can explode. Reporter Kelly Knoyer went to the demo to learn more.
It's a Southern tradition, a Cajun-injected turkey fried in peanut oil. And firefighter Chris Blanchard has perfected his recipe.
Then I put it in a brine for 24 hours. The brine is brown sugar, kosher salt, garlic, Worcestershire sauce.
He'll inject it with some Cajun butter, then use a mix of Cajun spices on the skin.
Coat it really good, put it back in the refrigerator while you're waiting on your oil to heat up, and then dunk it in. That's it.
It's got to be fully thawed and patted dry for safety reasons. Water and oil do not mix. The New Hanover County Fire Department had a pot set up outside, and when it came time to dunk the bird into the oil, Blanchard wore long sleeves and long pants with fire-safe gloves, the turkey on a long metal hook.
We're gonna lower it down slowly.
That's Brittany Melvin, the Community Risk Reduction Coordinator for the fire department. She set up this demo as a public safety announcement, hoping for a viral video. That's why she also set up a risky version of the turkey frying with a fire truck at the ready. A frozen turkey in hot oil can be a disaster. The ice on the outside melts and the water sinks to the bottom of the pot. The hot oil turns it into a whole lot of steam. That has to go somewhere and it can blow all the oil out of the pot and straight into the fire. For this demo, the frozen turkey got the bomb treatment, dunked in the oil from the end of a long pole with observers standing 40 feet away.
Oh, yeah.
Rube Goldberg, the release mechanism, you know?
So it just drops in.
It created a bit of a flare-up around the pot and the oil spat everywhere, but no real explosion to Melvin's disappointment.
New Hanover County Fire Rescue is so good at putting out fires that we can't start one.
But Blanchard says at least his Cajun turkey won't go to waste. It'll have a safe home in the bellies of firefighters.
So a covered dish thing today. So everybody kind of brought stuff, Thanksgiving-type foods, sweet potato pudding, rice and gravy. What else? Green bean casserole, bunch of different desserts.
Maybe this demo was just a fun excuse for a department potluck. And even though the test turkey didn't explode, Blanchard's secret recipe sure smelled nice. For NPR News, I'm Kelly Knoyer in Wilmington, North Carolina.
President Trump had an amiable, just about chummy meeting with New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mondami at the White House yesterday. The two men showered each other with praise and complimented each other on their political victories.
I think you're going to have hopefully a really great mayor. The better he does, the happier I am.
It was a remarkable show of mutual regard after weeks of vicious personal attacks. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has this story.
During the New York City mayoral campaign, President Trump called Mamdani a communist lunatic and threatened to cut off funding if he was elected.
Look, the Mamdani thing is it's a disaster waiting to happen. We can't have a communist in charge of a great supposedly free enterprise, kind of a representative city.
While Mamdani described himself as Donald Trump's worst nightmare, he called Trump a fascist and in his victory speech, a despot.
So Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
But on Friday, the two adversaries were full of smiles and promises to partner together on lowering the cost of housing and groceries, while they talked of finding common ground on thornier issues like crime.
I expect to be helping him, not hurting him. A big help, because I want New York City to be great. Look, I love New York City. It's where I come from.
and Mamdani returned the affection.
I appreciated the meeting with the president, and as he said, it was a productive meeting focused on a place of shared admiration and love, which is New York City, and the need to deliver affordability to New Yorkers.
Now both have mutual interests in making nice with the other. Mamdani wants to protect federal funding that Trump has threatened to withhold. The president has not shied away from using the levers of federal power to attack his opponents. And Trump, he wants to recapture his economic message that Mamdani has taken and tweaked into his own winning affordability message.
And I can tell you that there were more New Yorkers who voted for President Trump in the most recent presidential election because of that focus on cost of living. And I'm looking forward to working together to deliver on that affordability agenda.
The show for the public was all kind words. At one point, when a reporter pressed Mamdani if he still thought Trump was a fascist, the president gave him a pass.
I've been called much worse than a despot, so it's not that insulting. Maybe I think he'll change his mind after we get to working together.
But so much friendliness could come at a cost. Trump had been using Mamdani as a convenient foil, urging Republicans to paint him as the face of the Democratic Party. It was going to be a key talking point for the midterms. And he may well, again, decide confrontation is better than affection.
I mean, he's got views that are a little out there, but who knows? I mean, we're going to see what works, or he's going to change also. We all change. I change a lot.
But for now, this mutual praise could complicate Republican efforts to make New York City political ground zero. And it remains to be seen if other prominent Republicans follow Trump's lead when it comes to embracing Mamdani. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
Luke Bell was a promising young talent in country music. We interviewed him in 2016 about his self-titled album.
Referencing things in a subtle way is sort of a tip of the hat, and it's also what country music is about. I wouldn't go try to build a house without blueprints or having seen how anybody else builds a house. Or I'm sure I could get it done, but...
But the kitchen sink might be in the bedroom.
Right, right.
I get loud when I get mad. And I'll get tough when I get sad.
He opened for Hank Williams Jr., for Dwight Yoakam, and Willie Nelson. But behind the scenes, Luke Bell was struggling. He died in 2022 of a fentanyl overdose at the age of 32. Now friends and family have compiled 28 of Luke Bell's songs into a new album. It is called The King Is Back, and Luke Bell's mother, Carol, joins us now from Cody, Wyoming. Carol, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we are all so sorry for you about the loss of your son. Can you tell us about him?
You know, he was a really fun kid to raise. He walked into every room as if the king was back. He also struggled with insecurities. His lows were low and his highs were high.
Let me ask you about that phrase, the king is back. Where did that come from? I think of it as Elvis.
That is such a great insight. At the record release party, the gentleman who played the king is back said he could remember tapping Luke on the shoulder and when the first time he heard it and saying, that is such a great song about Elvis. And he said, Luke burst out laughing and said, that song's not about Elvis, that's about me.
I'm sure you've all been dying to see me. I bet you've all been wondering where I'm at. I heard things just ain't the same without me. Hold your hats, the party's on, the king is back.
We used to say in our family that Luke sucked all the oxygen out of the room. He just took up so much space. But he always liked to refer to himself as the prodigal son. He was like, I know you guys are glad I'm here.
It's high time somebody came a swing. It's high time somebody took a crack. It's high time for folks to start believing. Yes, that's right, the party's on and the king is back. Yes, that's right, the party's on and the king is back.
You have a story about the night that Luke opened for Dwight Yoakam.
I've listened to Dwight Yoakam since I was a teenager, and he probably was too, practically. And when Luke got serious about music, I had said to him, when you get to play with Dwight Yoakam, we'll know that you've arrived. I wanted to be sure I was at that concert, and my husband was 8 months into a pancreatic diagnosis and treatment. So I went by myself and invited my stepdaughter to join me there. And Luke and the band met us at a Mexican restaurant before the show, and they were wearing these Yoakam-esque polyester Western suits. And they were really pleased with himself, and I'm sure he'd spent his entire salary for that gig on those suits, which as a mom was a little stressful. But he was sure it was going to be worth it. And it was just so fun to see him in his element, being and feeling totally accepted and loved. I think that's every mom's dream come true.
Luke actually sang the title song of this album, The King Is Back, on that night, didn't he?
He did. That was the first time I'd heard it.
He didn't want to release it, though, I'm told. Why is that?
3 months after his dad died, he was home for my birthday, and he said very earnestly that he felt that if he released that song, people would think he was Jesus, and they would try and kill him.
What did that say to you at the time?
I'm sorry to admit that I knew so little about severe mental illness that I mean, I definitely felt like, Luke, you need to get some help. I can tell you're really stressed. Maybe you should come home and take a break for a while. You know, nobody's going to think you're Jesus. You know, I went back to school in 2019 and I have a master's in counseling now. And I know that this is a very common early sign of mental illness, that people often think they're Jesus or some other biblical figure, some kind of prophet.
Your son didn't avoid singing about mental health, emotional health, did he?
No, he sure didn't. He was a pretty open kid, person.
I wake up down and I beat myself up. Stare out the window of my pickup truck. I watch the weeds and trees whistle by. But your memory still makes me cry.
You know, a lot of people just hear songs about somebody who thinks he's great, but I hear the undertones, which are that people who are on top have often spent some time gnawing on the bone to find the fat.
I got the daydream blues. I'm not sure which one that I'd like to choose. The one of picking flowers for us. Making love the sun. Oh, the one where you kiss me so.
One of the reasons I've been so devoted to this project and to advocating for people with mental illness is because I feel like we often turn our backs on people when they need our love and support the most. And I think Luke was really aware of the ways that we hide our sadness and our pain. And I think his songs often show awareness of people in pain who are hiding behind something else. A cape, a crown.
A song, sometimes.
A song, absolutely.
There's cigarettes in heaven. Is there alcohol on the moon?
Carol Bell has just helped to release The King Is Back, new album of the music of her son, Luke Bell. Thank you so much for being with us, Carol.
Thank you for having me.
If you give me the head of a horse and the wings of a wildwood dove, you say, go hunt. Hey, honey, I just might say I don't mind.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The scientist E.O. Wilson once wrote that ants are the most warlike of all animals. He said clashes between ant colonies could make great military clashes seem almost small by comparison. Sometimes, instead of mass combat, ant colonies get conquered by stealth and deceit. In Paris, Nell Greenfield Boyce reports on how an ant colony can be tricked into betraying its queen.
For an ant colony, the queen is a big deal. She lays all the eggs. The workers protect her and raise the young. After a colony has been around a while and gotten bigger, some of the offspring will be females that are capable of reproduction. These females fly away and try to establish new colonies. Eric Frank is an ant expert at the University of Würzburg in Germany. He says the founding of a new colony is a precarious, fragile time. The would-be queen faces a lot of danger as she's out there on her own, laying the eggs that will produce her first workers.
Even one small mistake or one bad luck event that kills off your workforce can mean the end of the colony.
So, the females of some ant species avoid this risk by doing something tricky. They simply find an established colony, one that belongs to another queen. They kill off that queen and take her place so they can enjoy the protection and care of all of her workers.
It is very efficient.
Keizo Takasuka is a researcher at Kyushu University. He and some colleagues in Japan recently saw some female ants using a particularly devious method of defeating a reigning queen, which they describe in the journal Current Biology. First, he says, the female ant had to acquire some camouflage.
So she could invade into the colony.
Since ants mainly tell friend from foe using chemical signals, the researchers let the female ant have contact with some worker ants from a colony so she could get exposed to their scent. After obtaining that, she was able to creep undetected through the colony, right up to the queen. Then the female ant shot jets of fluid from her abdomen, dousing the queen in some kind of chemical before retreating to a short distance away. Takasuka says they haven't identified the chemical yet, but
it's my guess. It is formic acid.
That's used by some ants to signal danger. Whatever it was, putting this chemical onto the colony's queen had a dramatic effect. Swarms of workers who had been lovingly obedient, ready to protect her with their very lives, abruptly turned on her. They violently attacked her until she was dead. Eric Frank, the ant researcher in Germany, wasn't part of the research team, but he watched a video of the intruder's chemical spray and the colony's subsequent betrayal.
Obviously, there's absolutely zero benefit for the host colony to kill their own queen.
The only benefits went to the invader, the female ant that was now able to assume the throne.
I'm not surprised that the behavior occurs, but it was very cool to see.
He says usually this kind of royal ant drama happens underground in the dark, which is why ants rely so much on chemical signals and why they're vulnerable to this kind of trickery. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Oh, this is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXC. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 7:39. Support for KAXE comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Minnesota State Parks offer free admission on Friday, November 28th. Get out and explore your favorite park or find somewhere new. And the Arrowhead Library System presents Songs of Mesabi, a musical journey through the Iron Range with Greg Taberzi, now through December 10th. Find a list of dates, times, and locations at alslib.info. Coming up at 9, stay human. This week, spuds and rutabagas, radishes and a bouquet of garlic with savvy gardeners and savory cooks. That's this morning at 9, tomorrow evening at 5. Thanks for listening to KAXE. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene says she's planning to step down from Congress in January. Her exit from Georgia's 14th district is raising new questions about the future of the GOP's hard right wing. Greene took office in 2021. Scientists at COP30 say billions of lives are at risk without rapid cuts to fossil fuels. 80 nations are pushing for a global phase-out treaty. The annual climate conference was set to end Friday in Brazil, but delegates say they'll keep negotiating until an agreement is reached. A fire broke out on a ship at the San Pedro port in Southern California last night. The fire caused an explosion, but no injuries have been reported. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Zodiac Killer Project is a documentary about a documentary that never got to be made. Charlie Shackleton tried to buy the rights to a memoir that explored a theory about who might have murdered five people in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1968 and 69. But when the film deal fell apart, Shackleton still found a way to use all his B-roll of empty rooms, the sinister twangs of stringed instruments, shots of swaying overhead lamps, smoldering cigarettes, and spent shell casings to tell us about the documentary he maybe would have made.
If we'd made the film, there would have been a car here, and it would have been a California Highway Patrol car, but era-appropriate, so like a 1960s black cruiser with a white door. This would have all been reenactment, obviously. Just how all these things tend to start now. Like, everything's got to have that sort of rhythm of drama, even when it's documentary.
Charlie Shackleton joins us now from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You wanted the rights to a book written by Lyndon E. Lafferty, a retired California Highway Patrol officer. Why did you go ahead and make this kind of film without the rights?
Well, I've worked in documentary for about 10 years now, and it's certainly not the first time I've had a film fall apart at the first hurdle. But for whatever reason, this one I really couldn't get out of my head. I found myself, you know, just hanging out with friends back in London and describing to them almost beat by beat these scenes that I'd imagined for this documentary that I would never now get to make. And at a certain point, that started to seem like an interesting subject for film itself, you know, that feeling of creative frustration, of a creative dream that could never be realized.
You lead us through one technique after another in the making of what I'll call true crime, so-called documentaries. Please identify a few for us.
Yeah, I mean, there's countless, aren't there? You referenced one in your intro, the swinging overhead lamp, you know, of the interrogation scene. And that was one that it was only really in the voiceover booth recording the narration for this film, as that image came to my mind, that suddenly I could see the lamp swinging. And it seemed so self-evident that it would be swinging. But in that moment, I realized I had no idea why. What could have caused it to be swinging in the midst of this police interrogation?
Mm. I did not quite understand until seeing this documentary that serial killers and accused serial killers have three names. And I was skeptical at first, but I've covered a few cases, and you're absolutely right. They do have three names. Why?
I mean, so apparently the reason that they always seem to reliably have three names is that news reporters say the middle name quite pointedly so that they're not confused for anyone else who has the same first and second name. You know, if you're a serial killer who's called John Smith, you don't want every other John Smith in the country to suddenly be thought of negatively. So you say, you know, John William Smith or whatever it might be. But yeah, as a result, the second you say someone's middle name, suddenly they sound like a serial killer. It's almost kind of brings with it the association.
Yeah. And every community that's the scene of a true crime documentary are innocent seeming places. Am I right? Until something happens.
Yeah, I mean, this is the strange thing. Like, I had, you know, read plenty about the Zodiac Killer case before I ever went to Vallejo in California, where some of its key events took place. And having read all of those accounts, I almost expected to see the dark clouds forming overhead. But of course, these are just ordinary places. So I think a certain amount of that darkness and foreboding has to be superimposed.
Now, had you got your chance to make this film, you would have shown the library as the police station. Why would that be okay?
Well, I mean, when you're shooting reenactments for documentary, you're already kind of stepping into the realm of fiction to some extent, obviously, and having places and people and objects stand in for things that aren't the literal thing. I think what's interesting about the ethics of true crime is how those sorts of fairly minor distortions can fairly easily give way to much more serious ones. And that's something that the film tries to grapple with, is where you draw that line and how tempting it becomes to push it ever further.
I have watched true crime documentaries with our daughters. A lot of them, if not almost all of them, wind up with, finally, you see pictures of the victims. What are filmmakers trying to say there?
Well, I think they're trying to remind you that that's what we're doing here, you know, that's why true crime exists, is to pay tribute to the victims or do justice to the victims, seek closure for their families. And I think that while that can be certainly true, and that a lot of filmmakers go into this genre with the best intentions, often people's experience of it as something quite sensational, quite gruesome, doesn't necessarily feel like it's in service of the victims. And so, with a cynical eye, I think sometimes those moments where you're quite overtly reminded of the victims is the genre sort of acknowledging that maybe it's all too easy to forget.
Did you once make a 10-hour movie called Paint Drying?
I did. 10 years ago now, almost exactly, I made a 10-hour film of white paint drying on a brick wall, which I made as a sort of petty act of protest against the British Film Censor Board. If you want to release a film in Britain, you have to pay the censor board to watch it. And so I thought I would reverse the equation and force them to watch something that they didn't necessarily want to.
Did they make some kind of ruling at the end?
They did. I got my certificate. I got a U certificate for Universal. No material likely to offend or harm. So the film can now be legally exhibited in British cinemas, although anyone has yet to take me up on the offer.
So, but I can't see it on a streaming service now, can I?
No, sadly not. But, you know, only for lack of offers. If Netflix wants to pick it up, they're more than welcome to.
Well, Charlie Shackleton's new documentary, Zodiac Killer Project, is in theaters right now. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Back in the day, children would go outside to play with their friends and come back inside sometime before supper, but not so today. Many youngsters aren't even allowed to walk home from school without an adult. Yet online, many children are entirely unsupervised. Tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha, we'll look at why that doesn't have to be such a bad thing. You can tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Rabih Alameddine won the National Book Award for Fiction this week for his funny and moving novel, The True, True Story of Raja the Gullible and His Mother. Raja teaches philosophy to high schoolers and has lived through Beirut civil wars, a kidnapping, COVID, and the Great Port Explosion. But his most vexing test may be sharing his apartment with his 82-year-old sharp-tongued, dope-smoking, and utterly charming mother, Zalfa, of whom he writes, "Deciphering her was a feat that would have surely flummoxed Hercules, my mother, as the unthinkably impossible 13th task." When we spoke last summer, I asked Rabih Alameddine why Raja calls himself the gullible, the imbecile, the neurotic clown, the dimwit.
Self-deprecation, for the most part. Mm-hmm. It is how he sees himself. That's not to say that, you know, he is not more than that, but it's how he sees himself. And he uses that as, shall we say, a defense mechanism, for lack of a better word, something that keeps him sane.
And I have to ask you about a phrase that he and his mother bark back and forth. And we've got to be careful with it. You know what I'm talking about. But it's said with affection, isn't it?
Yes. Depending on the intonation, it could imply many, many things. But it is quite common and something that, yes, even my mother says to me.
Your mother says that.
Oh, yes.
Let's try and set up that phrase, if you could tell us. Let's ask you to read something from the book so we understand the phrase.
Okay. The first time it appears, the mother is speaking. "You're in extreme middle age," she said. "You're not allowed to be old. That would make me ancient." "But you are ancient." "Your mother." Her favorite expression, which always sounded off coming from her, even after years of hearing it. Anyone else saying it barely registered. But of course, my mother saying it to me was always strange.
I shouldn't laugh, but that's hilarious.
Oh, God, yes. Are you kidding? That's the whole point. You should laugh.
Tell us about Zalfa's relationship with Madame Tawil.
It's primarily an intimate relationship of two older women who found, at a late stage in life, a partner in crime.
And that's Madame Tawil's, vocation.
It's funny because I said partner in crime, not thinking about it, but yes, it's a partner in crime. She's what we call a generator mafia don. She runs generators and she sells and distributes generators. And that is a booming business in Lebanon because there is absolutely no electricity. Mm-hmm. And she's one of the best at it.
What do they find in each other?
You know, one of the things that was interesting to me about this book is the various, shall we say, loving relationships or the various intimacies in the book. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those who believes that we need different kinds of intimacies as humans. And one of the most important is somebody to listen to us no matter what we're talking about. And Raja, the main narrator, says at one point that he is his mother's confidant, but he's not the complete confidant that she needs. She needs somebody who will listen to everything that she has to say. The way I look at it is, it's about seeing someone completely or close to completely. And that's what they found in each other. Whereas no matter what Raja and his mother, however close their relationship is, it's still never complete because it's a mother and son relationship. Mm.
I have to ask, born in Amman to Lebanese Druze parents, mm-hmm. I gather you grew up in Kuwait and Lebanon. How much of this is drawn from your own family life experience?
Well, everything I've ever written is drawn from my family life and experience. It's not a direct reflection. The mother in the book is not much like my mother. However, it's quite emotional, but
yeah, sure.
The reason the mother is such a big thing in that book is because of my mother and what she's going through right now. So yes, that affects it and influences, but everything I do, everything I think about influences my novel. You know, I also played soccer for 50 years. Everything I do influences my writing.
Were you a striker or a goalie?
My primary position was on the bench, but
yeah.
I played midfield for the longest time, yes.
Yeah.
The beauty of being a novelist is that everything that comes across this insane brain of mine just goes into the novel. So yes, of course it influences, but I've never written directly about me.
Your mother's going through a tough period now?
Yes, my mother is 84, and she's Her health is wonderful. She's just losing her memory, and it's difficult.
The chronology in the story you tell here goes back and forth over decades.
Mm-hmm.
You write at one point, a tale has many tails and many heads, particularly if it's true, like life. It is a river with many branches, rivulets, and creeks. How hard is it to tell a story that way? How do you keep track of it?
It is hard, but in my mind, this is how we tell stories. A lot of people, a lot of wonderful writers, they separate writing from storytelling in some ways. The way that they would tell a story would be different than when you write it. The way that I tell stories is usually the way that I write. And I have never told a story going from, you know, point A to point B. There's always many digressions going back and forth and up and down and sideways. I usually say there are many kinds of writing. Some writing is like building a house one brick at a time. You know, you put this here, you put that here, and then you build this whole house. And a lot of say, 19th century novels are that way. And a lot of great novels are that way. I prefer, for me, novels that are more like threads going this way and that. Mm-hmm. And what you end up with is not a house, but a carpet, a nice Persian carpet. All these threads going in different ways, and you can follow this thread to go this. But in the end, it all comes together.
I'm going to be quoting that.
Please, please do.
So much of the back and forth between mother and son and crime boss and mm-hmm. her friend the mother, mm-hmm. and so much more in this novel makes us laugh.
Yes.
That's okay?
Absolutely. A lot of the trouble, I think, with the world is that we're too earnest. If we're unable to laugh at the world, to laugh at ourselves, that's a sad life. How can you look at what's happening in the world? How can I look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. as we speak? How do we deal with it if not just make fun of it and laugh about it? The world is silly. We can reach more people through humor than we can through, I don't know what to call it, portentousness.
That's a good one.
Yeah. You know, it's like, oh my God, this is going to happen. It's like, yeah, it'll happen. That doesn't mean that, you know, obviously it doesn't mean that it's not serious. Obviously it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be resisting or fighting or whatever you want to call it. But if you're not having a good time as you're doing it, it's a problem. Who was it that said, you know, if the revolution has no dance, something to the effect of, if the revolution doesn't have dancing in it, I want out.
That was Rabih Alameddine in August. His novel, The True Story of Raja the Gullible and His Mother, won the National Book Award for Fiction this week. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at RWJF.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's just before 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. And we operate translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. There's another hour of Weekend Edition ahead, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. And 10 o'clock, Jen Bue, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Weather for today, becoming sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s, winds from the south up to 20 miles per hour. Our lows tonight near 27 and mostly clear tomorrow with highs 45 to 50. Looking ahead to Monday, chance of rain in the afternoon, highs in the upper 40s. The Salvation Army in Hibbing has a free Thanksgiving meal on Wednesday, November 26 from 4 to 6. The event also features games, crafts, and karaoke. More news is next.